Right now it is time for the Media Beat with David Terachuk. Of course, David joins us every Friday morning. You can find David on his own website, themediabeat.us. Also, you can find him at Huffington Post, and he's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David.
Well, it's good to be with you.
You know, it's interesting. David always sends a little recap of what he's going to talk about. And I played a tribute to Hugh Masekela earlier this week. But you know, David, what the interesting thing about Hugh Masekela is when I was a kid, my father introduced us to all sorts of things. He was a little crazy, my dad, but he was a person who read a lot, listened to a lot, went a lot of places.
He can't be that crazy if he introduced you to Hugh Masekela.
Not only that, but Miriam Makeba.
Ah, of course. They were married for about 2 years.
Yeah.
But yes, the Mama Africa, she was known as. What a wonderful, wonderful singer.
Yeah, and they both, their music both had an impact on my life. And here I am, a 65-year-old, white guy from the White Hills of Northwest Connecticut in New York.
But well, you weren't 65 then.
No,
right?
but you were
young and open to all sorts of influences.
Well, that's the whole thing. But you know, until you get older and you see the history and you see how these people, you never realize the history and the struggles they came from.
Sure, and Hugh certainly came through struggles. He was born a black man in South Africa, so of course struggles. And Miriam Makeba also, as a young African woman, had the most appalling discrimination practiced against her. And like Hugh, like many talented South Africans, the talent got them out of South Africa, and they began to develop as artists and campaigners, because they were both of those things, abroad, with support of other people internationally. And of course, in Hugh's case, at least he was able to go back to South Africa after Mandela became president of a free, democratic, non-racial South Africa, the new South Africa, as it's been called. He went back and, of course, has become something of a grand old man of the struggle until his sad death earlier this week.
Well, I know this is one of the things that you really wanted to talk about and let people know and understand.
Well, Hugh was, Hugh was a communicator. I mean, my job is to to criticize and analyze people's communications supply, and by God, Hugh Masekela communicated a great deal to great effect. He's a jazz man, yes. I mean, there's no question about that. In some ways, he was a kind of slightly arcane jazz player. I mean, he was very much an early proponent of what was called Afro jazz, not a widely practiced form of jazz, but I mean, that's the point. Jazz is full of little interesting byways interesting, I mean, some improvisational kind of musical art. And of course, it's got all sorts of variations and varieties. He could be both mainstream and arcane and, often very, very individualistic. But he was also right there in the middle of the mass popular force of music, too, for South Africa. I mean, writing from abroad, of course, because he was living in exile, as so many opponents of the apartheid regime, the white supremacist theory that kept South Africa a divided country for so long, ever since the Brits took over as colonists in the 17th century, but in particular in governmental form, in official governmental form, since 1948, when the National Party, the party that invented the policy called apartheid, separate living, came in 1948 was when they came in. The 1950s was when the administrative complications of that policy got set in place, the pass system, the official pass system, which was inherited from the Brits, of course, back in the coal mine, in the gold and mining days. You had to have a pass to get from one kind of territory to another, and territories were divided up between black homelands and white areas. and all sorts of refinements on that. It was you know, possibly one of the most policed and regulated societies in the world, all based on racism. Apparently is hard for younger generations to even comprehend that now, but that's the way South Africa was. And he, like many opponents of the apartheid regime, had to operate from overseas. And from overseas, he wrote an extraordinary song, which was something of a game changer. It was simply called Bring Him Back Home, and you know who the hymn was. The hymn was Nelson Mandela in jail in the end for 27 years. He was initially sentenced to life imprisonment way back in 1964. So by the time he wrote that song, which took on like wildfire in South Africa and around the world as a campaigning song against the white regime, it was composed in 1986, and by then Mandela had been in prison for 22 years. But it wasn't long after that, and I do believe the song and all the other campaigning that went with it played a major part in getting Mandela released. He was released 4 years after that song was released. So, you know, Hugh was locked in the public mind in South Africa with the protests against apartheid, the eventually very successful protest against apartheid, which had, of course, many allies throughout the world, not least in the United States, where I think the divestment campaign, the campaign that was swept across the United States in the late 1980s, played institutions being lobbied to pull out their investments in South Africa. That had a huge effect on the white regime and pressured them into eventually releasing Mandela and entering negotiations with Mandela's party, the African National Congress, and then finally free and fair elections in which the African National Congress, of course, won mightily, and Nelson Mandela was installed as the first black president. And of course, Hugh and Mandela became very close. It was difficult to get close to Mandela, of course, for 27 years when he was in prison. But Mandela phoned Masekela and asked him to come back to the country. And of course, he did. And he's there. He was there still until this week, doing a great job as, in many ways, the sort of musical father of the nation.
And just for the sake of context, how long? Let's just, because we live in a completely compressed age, you know, when it's certain things are, shall we say, expressed as though they're going to be resolved overnight. How long did that little drama, let's call it, how long did that take?
David, you there? Did we lose David?
You lost me only for a moment.
Okay.
I see that there was a glitch on the communications there, but I'm back with you. Yes, the African National Congress was the oldest liberation movement in the entire continent of Africa, fighting against colonial presence of white rule. But it also was, and this is why it fascinated me so much, and I made so many television programs about it, one in particular, just tracing its history. It was the oldest liberation movement, but it was also the one that took the longest to, excuse me, it was the one that took the longest to achieve its aim. And because of the mighty forces arrayed against it, I think, it wasn't until, I mean, it started in 1912, won its aim in 1994. That's a long stretch of campaigning. And all of those campaigners had to, because of necessity, take a long view for their struggle. Quite a message, I think, for all people who want to institute change. Sometimes it just takes a long time.
And when one talks about Mandela in prison for 27 years and just tosses it off, you know, and I understand that it was a different time, etc. But
27 years in prison, yeah, no small thing.
But it's like, oh yeah, well that was 27 years, but that doesn't matter.
Well, for a moment to think about it. 27 years.
Yeah, exactly. 27 years. That's a lot of days.
Yeah, 27 years is a big slice of someone's life. And of course, and this is said all the time, but I can't repeat it enough, that it is extraordinary for a man to be in prison for 27 years, brutalized by his captors and his imprisoners, his prison warders, horribly right at the beginning and for a long time into that period of incarceration. But he comes out and is capable of an absolute ban on rancor for himself, and persuaded all his followers to abandon any form of rancor or revenge. It's an extraordinary achievement.
And one that probably could be mined for information and approach.
Quite a model, of course.
Yeah.
And in fact, the entire process of transfer of power in South Africa, which was achieved peacefully. And it didn't look at certain points as if that would be the case. I mean, it's now a matter of history, but it needn't have gone that way. It came very close to going an entirely different way. I remember the run-up to those free and fair elections was incredibly tense in 1994. In all the reporting in lots of different trouble spots across the world, it was the first time when I was forced to wear a flak jacket. And that was because political murders at the time were rampant, happening at the rate of one a day. And it was then that somehow or other Mandela turned everything around by the force of his example, I think, more than anything else, ensuring that the spirit of vengeance should be quashed for the period of that election. And indeed, it was, and it's sustained pretty much all the time since. There are tensions, of course. There are bound to be tensions with 300 years of racial domination to take into account. But on the whole, South Africa remains an example to us all of how to do a peaceful transfer from unjust power to democratic rule.
And again, something that could be looked at as a model. I hope that in the evolution of our system here, especially because we've got a lot of young people that dearly need models, I would say, that is observed, again, in the context of time and from the standpoint of having external, you have to have external ambassadors. It doesn't.
That's true. Yes, and indeed, the more help you get from a source, from sources spread across, not just your own community, but others too, can help. I mean, as I said, an awful lot of the ANC people conducted their struggle from overseas. There was, of course, a overseas-based military force involved. The ANC had a military wing based in nearby Zambia. Of course, there was guerrilla warfare carried out, and that was a pressure too. But worldwide, the ANC had supporters of all kinds. And just as a footnote, a very telling footnote, I think, Hugh Masekela, as a musical participant in this struggle, had support from overseas. It's an extraordinary story, which I write in my column this week, of Masekela getting his first, well, not his first, importantly, his second trumpet from America. The way it happened is that Trevor Huddleston, a priest, rather a kind of white progenitor before Desmond Tutu, the loudest Anglican the church spokesman against apartheid in those days, was Trevor Huddleston. He later became an archbishop, like Desmond Tutu did, and indeed had a lot to do with furthering the career of Desmond Tutu. He had been the one who spotted the talent of Hugh Masekela. He ran a jazz band in his local parish near Johannesburg in the townships there. He finally wasn't exactly expelled, but he made himself so much of an irritant to the South African regime that his own religious order decided to pull him out. And back out of South Africa, he wrote a powerful book called Naught for Your Comfort, which was a prime source of anti-apartheid campaigning. Very inspirational book that sold all around the world, and especially here in the United States. It had a great influence. Huddleston went on a tour of the United States promoting his book and arguing that America should disinvest from South Africa. And in the course of that, he went to a Louis Armstrong concert, met Louis Armstrong, the great Satchmo, told him about this juvenile jazz band that he had organized back in South Africa, and in particular the talent of this extraordinary 13, 14-year-old boy, Hugh Masekela, as a trumpeter in it, but bemoaned the fact that the trumpet he had was a battered old thing that rather squeaked rather than blurred at times. So Satchmo just said, and I'm quoting from what Trevor Huddleston told me, Satchmo grabbed his own trumpet, shoved it in Huddleston's hands, and said, "Give him this." So Huddleston, he couldn't go back to South Africa, but he shipped this precious trumpet to Hugh Masekela. And there was an extraordinary photograph of Hugh Masekela holding that trumpet once he received it in South Africa, just fresh out of the box, and he's jumping about 5 feet high, as far as I can see from the photograph, in joy, holding the trumpet in his right hand. And that was the trumpet with which he went on to slay audiences and become the great star that he was, and the great voice, you know, and blaring trumpeter for freedom in South Africa. So, you know, it helps to have international allies too.
And it also helps to have a universal language such as music. And when you again, it's what's most compelling about this entire journey and story is A, how long it took, and B, how many people were involved. And when you think that Graceland came out in 1999.
The Paul Simon album, on which Hugh Masekela played,
And was in, and that introduced a whole new group of people to the amazement.
African music, sure.
And
it wasn't an easy thing to do.
No.
The ANC was actually organizing an international boycott of South Africa then, it was controversial for Paul Simon to go to South Africa and perform there with South African artists. It went against the official ANC policy. So in the end, it became a subtler fight with more nuances than was initially intended. But in the end, I think now, looking back, people are rather glad for the cross-fertilization that resulted from that apparent break of the boycott.
Right. And that's, again, looking back and allowing things to evolve. And I think last year's word was context, and this year's word is going to be evolve. You've got to have positions that evolve. You can, I mean, it makes wretched television, agreed. But if you don't have the sense to incorporate information and life and et cetera, you are not necessarily going to end up where you need to.
Well, all struggles require patience. That's one of the messages of the Mandela experience. It's something that the second volume of his autobiography, written since he came out of prison, he didn't complete it himself, and it's been completed with help and published only recently, just a few months ago, makes that so abundantly clear. Mandela's message was that it takes time, taking time, of course, requires from every practitioner, every proponent of change, it requires enormous patience.
And that is something that is, at the very least, at a premium. Or, you know, I don't know that it really is from a grassroots standpoint, but I would just be so grateful if from a media standpoint, there could be just little injections of, right, well, you know, it's going to take more than a day.
Yeah, everything takes more than a day, except, you know, just living the day itself. Yes, I'm struck by our own media's sort of almost hothouse atmosphere of wanting change quickly. Well, of course, everybody wants change. Everybody who wants change wants it quickly. And it's so interesting to see certain really good journalistic outlets just carefully plugging away at themes. I see that both the New York Times, the New York Times initiated a story today, which the Washington Post very happily followed up. I think it clearly was working on the story already itself, and it had to play second peg, as sometimes happens. This is on the whole question of whether Trump tried to sack the special counsel Mueller back in June last year. Well, the New York Times has four insiders in the White House confirming that is exactly what happened. They're unfortunately unnamed, of course, because of the sensitivity of this situation, especially inside the West Wing, I would say. The Washington Post has two sources confirming it, again, anonymous ones, but they are satisfied themselves of the truth of their confirmation. And this is a story that we know has been plugging along for 8 months at least, and doubtless it will not die, and rightly so. This is a story of huge import. The president himself tries to dismiss it as he did at Davos this morning, saying it's fake news, folks. Another fake New York Times story. Typical fake New York Times story is what he said, but it requires diligence, and it seems, well, it doesn't seem, it has proven, isn't it, over time, that it requires repetition for stories like this to get established. If it's true, then it is right that the journalist should keep on saying it, and that's journalists' job, especially in the face of officialdom, which simply does denial, not refutation, but simple block denial. Just saying it's fake news isn't going to cut it.
And let's take that.
Especially when journalists do their job fully and bring out more evidence each time.
And let's please take that out of the political realm for a second and look at the U.S. gymnastics situation.
Sure. Again, consistency and insistence is required to get a story established in the face of officialdom's denials. Yes, again and again and again, journalists must circle around to the
and
same
that's,
story sometimes.
That's the point of the exercise. And I think that sometimes a huge disservice is done by focusing simply on the political realm.
Oh, sure. Yeah. All the Me Too realm is evidence, if ever there was, of the fact that issues have to be addressed again and again and again.
Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.
Thank you.